if not the first time people are documenting genocide or violence or discrimination. They've been doing it forever. People have chosen not to do anything about it. And making a choice not to do anything is still doing something. It's still making a choice.
Well, how would you like your family treated if this happened to you? Going to someone's home and taking all that they have without asking and just walking straight past them. Just try and imagine that for a minute.
They all told a very long story, a multi-generational story. It was always starting with what had happened to their great-grandmother or grandfather and then going through the generation.
Displacement is real, and that trauma that comes with all of that generational trauma is just piling up. It's almost like there's an explosion about to happen.
Welcome to The Making of Atrocities, Is Racism a Risk Factor? A podcast from the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation, an initiative of the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience that works alongside communities to amplify the voices of survivors and inspire collective action in countries struggling to confront human rights violations. This podcast addresses racism as a risk factor for atrocity crimes on a global scale and within the framework of racial justice and anti-racism. Each episode explores different manifestations of racism, from the racialized capitalism of colonialism and slavery to contemporary racial injustices in policing, media, and the economy. Our expert guests help expose how these manifestations increase the risk of atrocity crimes and affect the lives of people of color today. My name is Jordan Watkins, and I am a program associate at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and I'll be your host for this episode. I am joined by two experts in Indigenous communities and human rights, Councilwoman Imelda Davis and Dr. Corrine Demo. Councilwoman Davis is the first Black woman elected to serve on the City of Sydney Council in its 180-year history, a dedicated advocate for Australian South Sea Islanders, a second-generation-born Australian South Sea Islander, and a descendant of the Pacific slave trade to New South Wales in 1847. She is also a valued board member of the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. Dr. Corrine Demo was Director of Research for Canada's National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, drafting the final report as well as managing the Forensic Document Review Project and Legacy Archive. She is currently the Director of Indigenous Strategy for the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. In 2007, over 500 years after the first European invasion of the Americas, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. The Declaration recognizes that Indigenous people have long suffered as a result of the colonialization and dispossession of their lands, territories, and resources, thus preventing them from exercising fundamental rights such as the right to development. The United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs has noted special ongoing issues impacting Indigenous communities to include poverty, mistreatment of women and children, disparities in education and health, and environmental challenges. Racial discrimination towards Indigenous communities has also been prevalent throughout history. Such injustice towards Indigenous communities has resulted in atrocity crimes, including genocide and crimes against humanity, as defined by the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide and the Rome Statute. These injustices include forced displacement, forced assimilation, forced labor, dispossession, sterilization, and land theft. Throughout history, we have seen intentional targeting of these communities based on their Indigenous status. For example, in the 19th century, thousands of Cherokee people died on the Trail of Tears, a forced march removing Indigenous communities from the southern United States. There is evidence that Native Americans were given blankets infected with smallpox by European settlers in the mid-1800s. As discussed in Pox Americana, the Great Smallpox Epidemic of 1775 to 1781, an account of the early smallpox epidemic by historian Elizabeth A. Fenn. In recent years, the use of residential boarding schools to create forced assimilation and cultural erasure have taken the spotlight in the discussion of injustice towards Indigenous communities in North America. In order to understand the impact of atrocity crimes on Indigenous communities, we must frame these injustices within a historical context and address their contemporary legacies. As we have discussed in previous episodes, correcting racial inequities requires deliberate action to eliminate policies, practices, attitudes, and cultural messages that reinforce unjust treatment based on race. This can only be achieved through proactive and preventative measures. History is our best teacher. let's jump right in. For context, can you both provide a brief background to your work? What communities are you working with, and what does your work consist of? Councilwoman Davis, we'll start with you.
Culturally, I need to frame myself in that I am a proud Australian South Sea Islander woman. I'm living in Sydney, Australia on Gadigal country, which is one of the 29 clans of the Eora Nation. I am also Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander, and Caribbean descent. We find as we unpack the truth of our nation, we're seeing more and more the interconnectivity with our African diaspora in particular, and those interracial relationships and those names that actually are embedded across our communities, a lot of Indigenous communities, because we are an extension of Australia's slave trade. So the work that I've done is about truth-telling. I've got a career in film and television for some 28 years, but at the same time, working for state and government agencies, I've always been a grassroots activist, social justice person. There's a lot to talk about in terms of my skill, but at the same time, it's not without the work of our forebears and those elders that have paved the way for the struggle that we still are advocating for in terms of human rights for our people.
And my name is Karen Zamal. I'm a proud member of the Red Rock Indian Band, which is a First Nation that was created through kind of combination of bringing different groups of people together through what we have in Canada called the Indian Act. My community is located in Northwestern Ontario, and I'm an off-reserve member of that community. I just want to take a second to recognize our ancestors, my elders, knowledge keepers, all of whom have generously shared their knowledge with me and really informed what animates my work, which is really my wish one day to be a good ancestor too. I am Anishinaabe and of mixed European ancestry, and my family, like many other families, have really been affected by the history of Canada and the history of European settlement on these lands. I have come into this space both as a person with lived experience because of who I am, but also through my work, working with families of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people. So I serve as Director of Research for the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. I still work in research, although the National Inquiry concluded its mandate in 2019. I'm still an active contributor to lots of different projects that are run by communities across the country. I work in history, I work in museums, I work in public education, but I also work with the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council in Canada, working to support Indigenous researchers who do really important work. So that's sort of how I've come into this. And, you know, it's always so important to me to take the opportunity to be able to share on behalf of lots of the families that came forward to talk to us some of the experiences, not only that they've had, but that they continue to have, including land theft, forced sterilization, forced relocation, residential and day schools, violence against women, the Indian Act, and other aspects that continue to place our people in danger.
It's important to frame the context we are discussing. How have your communities been affected by racial injustice economically, culturally, and socially?
I mean, there's no real way to underscore the extent to which our communities have been impacted by racial injustice in terms of economic equality, culturally and socially. Indigenous communities in Canada obviously have been here since long before Europeans came. Statistically speaking, it's true that Indigenous people in Canada, whether they're First Nations, Métis or Inuit, have far poorer health outcomes, poorer life expectancy, lower levels of income, broadly speaking, lower levels of educational attainment, face higher risk for violence, victimization. And so all of the things that come together to create the communities and the environment in which we live include things that dramatically affect individuals and communities. In addition, the imposition of kind of Euro Canadian values and knowledge systems means that Our cultures are also always sort of under threat, right? We're working to revitalize languages. We're working to preserve languages. We're working to preserve teachings and cultures. All of the things that have been really targeted, I would argue, bi-colonial project and genocidal project. We often talk about in academic circles how genocide happens. And in Canada, the conversation has really focused in the last several years on the residential school system. And while that's certainly an important contributor to the outcomes that people face today, it's important to look at this a little bit more holistically as a structure of things, all of which work to do the same thing, which is essentially to destroy Indigenous people, to eliminate Indigenous people, and to destroy and undermine Indigenous communities and Indigenous ways of knowing.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, Corinne. It's common globally. What you're saying is no different to the challenges we've got here for our First Nations and Australian South Sea Islander communities. And I think genocide is one of the largest issues from the advocacy work that I'm doing. And yes, we've got cultural revival for First Nations community, but the intersectionality of that community is the Australian South Sea Islanders who were recognized as population transfer under the United Nations in 1993. And we're still grappling with how to actually, despite the Commonwealth recognition for our people, those slaves from the Pacific in 1994, 2000 and 2013, and more recently in my term on Council for Local Government. And still it's like falling on deaf ears of those politicians and those people that can actually bring about real change in policy and program and commitment. But it's almost like they're conditioned to the degree, our politicians, where it's almost like they're programmed to just forget and not be able to grasp the atrocities that have occurred. Like, it's always this deep and meaningful conversation when it equates to, well, how would you like your family treated if this happened to you? It's a very simplistic way of looking at things. But, and I say that to a lot of politicians, it's just, you know, like going to someone's home and taking all that they have without asking and just walking straight past them. Just try and imagine that for a minute. The systemic racism is something that people still continue to ignore, even though the 1901 White Australia policy was supposed to have been defunct in 1973 or thereabouts. The remnants of that are still in that conditioning of those generations that implemented that policy. It sits in the subconscious. It's like automatic, you know, the go-to perspective or ignorance, really. But I find that the grooming is our own in terms of all the Black excellence and all the Indigenous excellence and all that wonderful stuff that's going on for communities through self-determination grants and programs. It's very good. But at the same time, it's grooming our people as a part of a colonial project of oppression in another form. And these are creating even more barriers, because I'm facing Black on Black politics in relation to Australian South Sea Islanders. We are the descendants of some 60 odd thousand that was stolen from 80 islands of Vanuatu and Solomon's Pacific nations, brought to Australia, the whole population transfer thing under a policy that denied people of colour any rights whatsoever. The ignorance is just profound. Like, have we not learned from what's occurred on a global scale? It's a challenging and sad situation, but at the same time, I'm so much stronger as a person, personally, for the advocacy work and what's been handed down through the ancestors, giving me the confidence as a Black woman to stand up as a First Nations, South Sea Islander, Pacific, you know, wherever you're from in the world, you're a First Nations person, yeah? Displacement or not, we should be celebrating diversity in all our bloodlines, because we're all made up of something. I did my DNA. My father's from the Caribbean, and I am 30% Nigerian. So it empowers me to think that Nigerian, Benin, like all of these amazing, staunch African countries, and also Melanesian, it puts it into context. Australia's a Black country. It's got 500 clan groups before colonization, 230 surviving languages and 120 spoken languages today, reviving languages. And the Pacific is tenfold on that in terms of the diversity of indigeneity and representation, but yet it's such a white country, if I can say that.
What sort of approaches have been taken by communities, local governments, and national governments to address injustices towards Indigenous people?
The thing about Canada and, well, every country really, have been the diversity of Indigenous communities. People are working, they've been working, they're continuing to work, and they've been working for generations, all to try to address discrimination. And there's so many communities, but there's also so many injustices, right? And so there's people working in all different areas, through grassroots organization, through organized politics, through kind of organizational advocacy. As Indigenous people, we've been doing this for a long time. And it's not that we haven't been doing it. It's that, especially I would say in Canada, but I'm sure in other places too, people are just starting to listen. In Canada last summer, we had essentially the discovery, and I don't even like to use that word, but the discovery of thousands of unmarked graves tied to residential school sites and various communities. And so there's so much to address and there's so many things to talk about. But in Canada, one of the interesting things that's happened over the last couple decades, I would say, is much of the focus has really shifted to the processes of inquiries or truth commissions. In 1990s, we had the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, which was focused on residential schools, published its final report and its calls to action. In 2019, the National Inquiry, which is the one that was focused on violence against Indigenous women and girls, published its final report called Reclaiming Power and Place. And so there's been, I would say, gradually and accelerating more recently, a transition to a sort of more rights-based focus, particularly in Canada with the more recent implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act and its integration into Canadian law. What I'll say is, while I think there's value in these things, I know there's value in them, I also think that there are limitations to these kinds of mechanisms more generally, which is to say that often truth commissions or inquiries are a way that the state archives itself. Part of the way that they do that is they usually are always launched in a time of post-atrocity. And so they're a way of generating a record, a public record, as it tells a particular story. And I think that's important to see. That said, I'll talk a little bit about the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, which was quite unique. And the National Inquiry started its work in 2016, 2017, really with a very unique mandate. And it was the largest and broadest mandate ever given to any National Inquiry or Commission in Canada, which was really to look into and report on the systemic causes of all forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls, including sexual violence. And then also we were asked to examine the underlying social, economic, cultural, institutional, and historical causes. So all the things, really, that contribute to violence. We were asked to do that without a beginning or end date, without a particular geographical kind of location or any kind of limitation. And so while the mandate was a challenge, it was also a real opportunity. It was an opportunity to be able to tell the story of violence, of systemic violence, in the way that people told it. And I say that because during the process of the National Inquiry, we had nearly 3,000 people come forward to share their stories about, you know, being targeted for violence and for discrimination and all the things that go with that. And, you know, every single person that came forward, even though their story was very unique, depending on how old they were and where they came from and what community they were from, all of the stories were also very similar in the way that they all told a very long story, a multi-generational story about violence. It was never about what had happened to their loved one in the last year, in the last 5 years, or in their life. It was always starting with what had happened to their great-grandmother or grandfather, and then going through the generations. And so as part of that work, and because the mandate was so broad, we had quite a bit of flexibility. And I credit also our commissioners for pushing forward really hard on this work to make sure that we were able to tell the story and share the story that people told us. in the end, we talked to many, obviously different people, and they all shared their stories. And we came out with a report that identified four kind of root causes. And that's sort of how I want to frame my thoughts on this, which is to say that what approaches have been taken, we argued as part of the national inquiry that any approach taken had to kind of answer to or be accountable to the root causes that people had identified. To various degrees, they have been, and then sometimes they haven't been at all. So the first one that we talked about was this issue of addressing intergenerational and multigenerational trauma, essentially providing access both to individual, but also to collective healing for communities, for families, for everybody who has been targeted, who has been affected, to be able to engage in a healing process that is equitably resourced and supported in the way that it should be, given, you know, who globally the perpetrators have been. The second root cause that we identified was social and economic and political marginalization. So the way in which Indigenous peoples have been shut out of decision-making, shut out of economic prosperity, shut out of the social fabric of who we tell ourselves that we are as Canadians. And I use Canadians in air quotes, even though people can't see that, because I think it's important. The third root cause that we talked about was just a lack of political will as folks maintaining the status quo. As a historian, I went into the records, and it's not like it's the first time people are documenting these issues. It's not the first time people are documenting genocide or violence or discrimination. They've been doing it forever. It's just that people have chosen not to do anything about it. Legislators have chosen not to do anything about it. And making a choice not to do anything is still doing something. It's still making a choice. And then the last root cause that we identified as part of that process was the denial of the agency and the expertise of Indigenous women, of elders, of knowledge keepers. And, you know, what sort of approaches have been taken, I think, in the aftermath of that report? We called that report Reclaiming Power in Place because we saw that as the route through which we could start to address some of these issues. In Canada, the approach to trying to address some of these issues has been a little bit like that game of whack-a-mole where you just hit at things and you hope for the best. And that's not effective because it still fails to take account of these very important sort of root drivers. We have the inquiry, we published the report in 2019, and one of the things we wanted to do to make sure that it would get some traction is we wanted to identify all of the things that the government of Canada and provincial governments have said that they would do within a rights-based context and have not done. So we were very deliberate about tying a lot of these obligations to international and domestic rights instruments, so that family members could, you know, if nothing happened in 2 years and 5 years and 10 years, could go back and say, these are rights violations. And here's international community, domestic community, all communities. What should we do about that? A lot of communities are doing a lot of work, specifically in the area of addressing violence. Communities are going forward to reclaim kind of cultural practices and knowledges. To talk about how traditionally communities had a ways of keeping people safe, of supporting safety for all community members. Thinking about how do we do that in 2024, in 2025, in 10 years time, in 20 years time? How can we use that knowledge to move forward? In terms of government, I think the approach continues to be a little bit the game of whack-a-mole. We had published 231 calls for justice. Of those 231 calls, very few, if any, have been fully and substantively implemented according to the principles of what we're trying to achieve here, which is transformative change. It's like change to the very fabric. What we argued in the report is that communities and nations need to be properly supported and resourced to do this work. Because at the end of the day, if we're really serious about supporting self-determination, then we need to accept that communities and nations are best placed to determine the course forward. And then we need to do the things to make that happen.
I come from a long family background that saw recognition of Australian South Sea Islanders of activism in 1994. But leading up to that was also the yes vote for Aboriginal people to be included in the census in 1967, which was headed up by an Australian South Sea Islander woman with a lot of staunch Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders. And that was, for me personally, when I reflect on that time and then my time growing up in Sydney, in Redfern, but also from a very Northern Rivers, New South Wales country town, coming to the city, I had so much more influence through grassroots movements. The fact that we as people of colour, black people, whatever you want to call it, bohemian black community, back in the 70s, we were so much stronger and so much more family orientated in terms of interconnectivity with just, we were one mob, we say, and everybody was on that same course for justice. And it was informed by the Black Panther movement. So people found money to go overseas and example that Black Panther movement and brought that movement back here, informing the Aboriginal Medical Center and looking after our children and after school care and teaching our children, and black dance in Australia being influenced by an African American woman, Carol Johnson, who's from Philadelphia. And she brought so much empowerment to the mob through changing the narrative of Australia literally through dance and culture and working with First Nations communities and South Sea Islander communities. But now, since we've had Native Title, there's such a divisive through the in the 90s, giving land rights, which is critical for communities in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. I'm finding that there's a lot of black politics and divisiveness happening. And it's almost like crabs in a bucket, and everyone's just at an instant ready to combat or challenge their brothers and sisters. And I think that's going to be a huge challenge in how do we get past that, because identity is real and it's a challenge. Displacement is real, and that trauma that comes with all of that generational trauma is just piling up. It's almost like there's an explosion about to happen. So through my work on council, getting a systemic strengthening commitments to address systemic racism and institutional racism across the workplace. Working on that has just been the most complex, like really pushing that need for engagement. Every time we get some sort of government recognition, at least one person's mind is going to change somewhere, somehow, and they're going to make a difference somewhere, somehow.
We often see that initiatives designed by those removed from the injustice do not always encompass the needs and intentions of the injured party. How have your communities responded to justice initiatives? Are they actively involved?
There's a lot of gatekeeping going on with some of these programs and policies that are being rolled out. And then there's this marginalization through identity. So what that looks like, the black deaths in custody challenges, the jails are full. 98% of the population in most of our jails are either First Nation people of colour, black people, however they want to identify. And I want to refer back to the fact that we do find success if we drop the boxing of identity to a certain degree. Yes, we're all distinctly different. Yes, we're all distinct cultural groups, but we need to get back to blackness or people of colour and start working more effectively on the greater inclusion and rebuilding of communities that have those diverse cultures in. We have so much intersectionality with Pacific African people of colour find respite and connection, real connection, when you're with your people. It's like Australia's built on multiculturalism. And it's almost people are forgetting that this is a black country and that these people have traveled and contributed to the nation. But yet the policies that are rolling out through multicultural affairs, etc., are marginalizing everybody. It's not just First Nations people. It's everybody. It's this conditioning of how we need to behave with each other and this fear-mongering around First Nations issues, almost like other people can't even speak about it, when it's a shared history, it's a shared knowledge, it's lived experience, and it's a shared lived experience. And atrocities have occurred for most people in this diverse multicultural society, and it's not that any one person's experience is worse than another, but at the same time, we need to respect distinct groups and their challenges.
I think it's fair to say there's lots of gatekeeping also in Canada, and the government of Canada really focused a lot of its effort on what it calls its broader reconciliation agenda, which prioritizes relationship building or relationship-based work and talks a lot about co-development. There is many people working on this, many organizations, representative organizations for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit working on this. But I think also if you went and sort of anybody from any community across the country, do they feel included? Do they feel heard? They might not have the same answer, right? Do they feel represented? I'm not sure. But I do know that there's been some steps taken. But I think that, you know, it's taken us over 500 years to get to the point where we are, and it's going to take a really long time to get out of it too. So to some extent, I think we have to take a bit of a long view here and say that what we're actually contributing to or what we're trying to address doesn't have any quick solution, doesn't have a quick solve or a silver bullet. What it has is community people working on this and transmitting that passion to future generations continue to work on this. On the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, which is really what I focused on, there have been some positive developments. After the National Inquiry had a some advisory groups that included or were actually exclusively comprised of family members. And so many of those family members, after the inquiry ended, became involved in kind of the next version of this group, which is called the National Family and Survivor Circle. And the National Family and Survivor Circle is a pretty historic, or the establishment of this circle is a pretty historic step, because it's really demonstrated a level of integration of families and survivors into kind of policy development, policy making, and program creation that hasn't necessarily been seen before and really has focused on co-development. The National Family and Survivor Circle is made up of Indigenous women and family members, Two-Spirit people who have loved ones who are missing or who have been murdered and who come from a real diversity of communities from across the country. So they're continuing to do really important work and really trying to work to hold the government accountable. And we're continuing to work. I think sometimes it feels like we're doing better and sometimes it feels like we're not. Ultimately, for me, and I know for the family members, when we get tired, when it starts to become like too much, we just think about our loved ones. I think about the folks who came forward and shared the story about Deidre, who, you know, always had tea on for anybody that needed to come in and have a warm cup of tea. And I remember her daughter coming and talking about how she had a lap so big it could fill a whole room. Or I think about Michelle, who worked to make her brother's birthday special every single year, even when their mother wasn't able to care for him, and would put notes in his lunchbox so that he had a great day. In the inquiry, we had a thing talking about, we would always say, our women and girls are sacred. Our women, girls, and Two-Spirit people are sacred. We need to think about, because when people came forward to share their stories, and I find even whenever people come and share stories about their experiences in Canada with me, they never start with like what happened to their loved one or what happened to them. They always start by talking about that person. They'll talk about what made that person special. They'll talk about why they love that person or what's missing now. That person's not there anymore. Well, I do think that it gets really heavy. It's hard to carry, right? But I just think about Deidre and I think about Michelle. And I think about Jennifer and I think about Julia. And I think about all of these people and how important it is that we continue the momentum, because I probably, unless science does something miraculous, won't be around to see a Canada in which Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit people are as safe as anyone else, where those folks can walk around and they can go to university or not if they don't want to, and they can attain whatever jobs they want, and they can live wherever they want, and they can enjoy all of their rights as Indigenous people in this country. But I think that what we're doing now, and just this awareness and the way that people are really involved in the growing of movements, like, we have to remember that movements are made by people. And we just keep building, and we'll keep building. And I think at some point, maybe we can say, yep, you know, people really feel heard, will really feel like it's going well. I don't think we're there yet, but certainly I would say, at least in Canada, there's been some positive strides, and we'll just keep building.
Thanks for listening to The Making of Atrocities, Is Racism a Risk Factor? A podcast from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. A special thank you to our guests on this episode, Councilwoman Imelda Davis and Dr. Corrine Dummo. I've been your host, Jordan Watkins. The International Coalition of Sites of Conscience is a global network of over 350 historic sites, museums, and memory initiatives in more than 65 countries. The International Coalition of Sites of Conscience is a global network of over 350 historic sites, museums, and memory initiatives in more than 65 countries, all dedicated to using past struggles to address social injustice today. This podcast is brought to you by the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation, GIJTR for short, which is a flagship program led by the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience and consisting of 8 additional global organizations committed to promoting just and sustainable peace in conflict and post-conflict countries. GIJTR does this in a participatory, inclusive, and holistic manner, building the capacity of survivors and local civil society organizations to foster locally led initiatives that promote memory, truth, and justice.